Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
I'd shut down the FBI Hoover building on day one and reopening the next day as a museum of the deep state. And I'd take the 7,000 employees that work in that building and send them across America to chase down criminals. Go be cops.
We're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you. Whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice.
That was Kash Patel, Donald Trump's pick to be the next director of the FBI, speaking on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast last year, laying out a chilling agenda for a new Trump administration, a plan to use the powers of law enforcement to extract revenge and retribution on perceived political enemies, including journalists. It's one of many provocative comments by Patel that have raised questions about his suitability for one of the most sensitive and powerful jobs in government. But were he to be confirmed and FBI Director Christopher Wray fired, what impact would he actually have on the country's premier law enforcement agency, one that is charged with thwarting terror attacks, uncovering cyber intrusions, busting drug cartels and child pornography rings, and much more, including investigating the foreign agents seeking to steal America's secrets? We'll talk to Garrett Graff, a journalist and historian who has spent years chronicling the successes and abuses of the FBI on this episode of Spy Talk. Garrett Graff, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, it is. And I got to say, I still remember reading your epic book, The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War in the Age of Global Terror, and just amazed at the access and reporting you did about the FBI, which made me want to talk to you as we explore this apparent nomination of Kash Patel to be the next director of the FBI. You just wrote in the New York Times in a piece the other day that this is one of the more troublesome nominees. He is more concretely dangerous and worrisome than many of Trump's other questionable choices. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, the world of Trump nominees over the last couple of weeks, is united perhaps only in their lack of qualifications to do any of the jobs that many of the senior national security people have been nominated to do. But I think what makes Kash Patel stand out, even among troublingly unqualified nominees like Pete Hegseth, who at the time of our recording is still in play to be Secretary of Defense, but that seems like that might change hour by hour. So by the time someone is listening to this, he might be long gone. Or someone like Tulsi Gabbard, the nominee to be Director of National Intelligence, who is herself, you know, remarkably unqualified and, sort of widely viewed as a useful idiot for Russian propaganda. What makes Cash Patel, I think, so concretely dangerous is the ideological and distinctly partisan mission he is coming to the Bureau to implement. You know, you have covered the FBI as well for many, many years. And, you know, the FBI, for all of the complaints about its abuses or, you know, surveillance powers or, you know, problems, which we can explore later in the conversation, the one thing the FBI has tried really hard to do for the last century is be politically independent. And presidents, both Democratic and Republican presidents, have nominated director candidates who are distinctly not political appointees. You know, people who have a track record of public service, a history of law enforcement experience, and then let them do whatever they do as director. Only one FBI director prior to Donald Trump's first presidency was ever fired for cause, William Sessions. And he was fired after a very extensive and damning investigation into both sort of his abuses of office and taxpayer expenses, and, you know, was condemned by both the outgoing president, George H.W. Bush, as well as the incoming president, Bill Clinton, who eventually fired Sessions for cause. Every other FBI director has left the job of their own accord. And that's a really important sign of political independence. And, you know, presidents have not been happy with the decisions of many of those FBI directors along the way. You know, the man Bill Clinton eventually chose as his FBI director, Louis Freeh, turned pretty explicitly on Clinton amid Clinton's unfolding scandals. And the two men didn't speak for the final years of Bill Clinton's presidency. Louis Freeh actually even turned in his White House visitor pass to avoid even the appearance of familiarity with the president. And now we have Cash Patel. And Cash Patel is coming with a very explicit ideological and partisan agenda. This is someone who has, you know, been vocal at Trump-Vance campaign rallies. You know, this, you know, just imagine the idea of an FBI director nominee ever speaking at a presidential campaign rally in the past. He published in a book a list of 60 targets, you know, Trump enemies that he wants to explicitly go after. And he has said that he wants to prosecute journalists.
Right. By the way, you know, that is the comment that has gotten a lot of attention. We're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminal or civilly. We'll figure that out. What is he conceivably talking about there when he says we're going to come after you?
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. One is, you know, there is a view in some corners of MAGA world that, you know, you could actually prosecute journalists or, you know, people who are part of this censorship, disinformation, deep state that they imagine exists, that, of course, is entirely fictional and made up in their minds. But I think to me, the thing that actually most worries me is not the absolute worst case example of, you know, journalists ending up in FBI concentration camps, which I think is unlikely for a variety of reasons. Not impossible, you know, non-zero chance.
They don't,
but
for the moment, they don't exist. But, yeah. You know.
But as you know, from your career and experience, the FBI can do a lot to ruin a career, a family, a person's finances, even if it doesn't end up with criminal charges at the end of an investigation. The FBI has enormous powers with the Justice Department to, you know, persecute someone if they don't like you. You know, it is not, that's not the way that the Justice Department is supposed to approach its investigations. But I think a lot of people overlook the extent to which that persecution element, I think, probably drove the Hunter Biden pardon by President Biden. That, you know, I really see the Hunter Biden pardon as basically a knee-jerk reaction to Kash Patel's nomination literally the day before as FBI director.
Interesting
sort of
point.
This idea that, you know, Hunter Biden got such a oddly sweeping pardon that I think it is best seen as Joe Biden reading Kash Patel's nomination on Saturday night and saying, you know, the Trump Justice Department is never going to leave my son alone. And the one thing I can do for him is give him this pardon. And I think people sort of wrongly have been looking at it as Biden pardoning Hunter for the things that he had already done, for the cases that had already been adjudicated. Whereas I think it's much more of a preemptive pardon to prevent Kash Patel and Pam Bondi from persecuting Hunter for years to come.
I mean, well, Biden probably would have been better off if he had explicitly said that instead of suggesting that politics had infected his son's prosecutions, even though it was done by the Merrick Garland Justice Department. And that argument had been rejected by explicitly rejected by two federal judges.
Yes. Yeah, I won't argue that Biden poorly presented his pardon, but I think the context of Kash Patel on Saturday night and this pardon coming out of the blue on Sunday is hard to disentangle.
Right. But look, your point about the enormous power of the FBI, its surveillance capabilities, its use of FISA warrants to snoop on suspected spies and terrorists with certainly very little public oversight, is a reminder that of as you say, what the FBI can do to a person. And we should point out in Kash Patel's meager defense, and this may be the only time I defend him, he was right about calling out the abuses in the FISA warrant of Carter Page, a one-time foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump. You know, he drafted the memo that said the FBI had wrongly used the, you know, unconfirmed, uncorroborated Steele dossier to get a FISA warrant on this foreign policy advisor. You know, the Democrats said, no, that wasn't the case, as it turned out from the Inspector General's report. Patel was right about that. Mostly right about that. And Adam Schiff and the Democrats were wrong. And if you read the stories about the evolution of Kash Patel's extreme thinking, that was a big moment for him when he actually correctly called out an abuse by the FBI.
I won't argue with that, except to say, I think to me, the challenge is not and has never been that there are not things to fix at the FBI. The challenge is he is coming and Donald Trump is choosing him specifically because of this vision to weaponize the FBI both against the opponents and sort of perceived enemies of Trump and Trump's administration, but also to avoid the prosecution of Trump's friends. And I think that that to me is one of the things I wrote about in the wake of Patel's nomination, which to me, one of the things that really worries me about having someone as nakedly partisan as Patel atop the FBI is the FBI is the only federal law enforcement agency in the country that handles public corruption cases. It's really actually, you know, one of the only law enforcement agencies at any level in the United States that handles public corruption cases, you know, abuses of by elected officials, abuses of public trust, you know, government corruption. And to me, one of the things that a nakedly partisan FBI director does is it's not just about the persecution of enemies. It's also a very clear message to all of the grifters in the Trump orbit that it is now open season on graft and bribes and corruption. You know, you don't have to worry about the FBI coming after you if you are sufficiently loyal in the, you know, Donald Trump, Pam Bondi, Cash Patel administration.
Right. Right. And that is a very good point. By the way, my point on the FISA warrant on Carter Page is it underscores just how much power the FBI does have to surveil American citizens without their knowledge. And you want them to get it right every time. And, you know, when they get it wrong, which they sometimes do, you know, that is a problem. And that's something people on the left have warned about for years and have decried the secrecy surrounding the FISA process. You know, it's one of those weird moments that people on the right are adopting some of the language and critiques that have been used by people on the left.
Absolutely. And I think to me, what all of that says, and for those of us who know our FBI history, and you certainly do, and probably a lot of the listeners to this podcast do as well, we know what a weaponized FBI looks like.
Yes.
It is exactly the FBI that J. Edgar Hoover had perfected by the late 1960s and early 1970s. Right. In sort of the final years of his half century reign.
That's a good moment to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of those historic abuses by Hoover's FBI and why they are worth keeping in mind as the country considers a Cash Patel in charge of the agency. And we're back. Before the break, Garrett was talking about the kinds of tactics that J. Edgar Hoover used when he was head of the FBI. Tell us about them.
It was a FBI that routinely abused the civil rights and civil liberties of ordinary Americans. It was an FBI that routinely persecuted political enemies from, you know, civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King to, you know, black literary leaders like James Baldwin,
anti-war activists, sure.
To you know, all manner of people who were not seen as sort of sufficiently pro-American.
And some of that, I should say, some of that was J. Edgar Hoover himself, who had certain obsessions. But a lot of it was also, you know, pressure from the White House to, you know, crack down on anti-war dissidents. Lyndon Johnson certainly wanted Hoover to be doing that.
Yeah, you know, it was an FBI that helped blackmail homosexuals. It was an FBI, blackmailed Martin Luther King, and one of Hoover's deputies sent a, you know, suggested suicide note to Martin Luther King. This is the FBI dirty laundry that comes out over the course of the 1970s, and America collectively recoiled from that. You know, Congress recoiled, presidents recoiled, the American people recoiled, and we have spent 50 years building up safeguards and new oversight regimes and new norms, like the 10-year term limit for an FBI director, to try to ensure that the FBI is never weaponized again. And so I think, to me, the challenge is, not that the FBI is perfect by any means, but that, you know, we know exactly what the worst case scenario for a weaponized partisan political FBI looks like. And America didn't want that and doesn't want that and has tried to undo that for half a century.
Right. Although, you know, just to touch on another subject you've written about, wrote a whole book about Watergate, in many ways, it was it triggered, you could argue, the whole Watergate scheme and the creation of the Plumbers, because J. Edgar Hoover refused to go along with the Houston memo to conduct surveillance of and wiretapping without any court orders of suspected dissidents that the Nixon White House was determined to go after.
But even then, I think actually you're absolutely right. But even that underscores the reform nature of the FBI, which is in the Nixon administration, in the final years of J. Edgar Hoover's reign.
Yes.
He was beginning to realize that all of the terrible things that he was doing were not politically popular anymore. And that he was refusing to do for Nixon the things that he had routinely done for previous presidents,
right?
And for himself, going back to, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, who he did, you know, enormous political favors for. And it was sort of Nixon's frustration with the, like, hey, you broke all these laws for everyone else. Like, what's a guy got to do to, you know, get some illegal wiretaps here that led him to launch his own plumbers unit, as you said, that, you know, then yada, 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 Watergate unfolds.
Right. Now, you know, over time in that period of, you know, the reformed FBI, in which there were still plenty of abuses, which we could talk about, but there were moments of arguably real heroic stands for the rule of law. And I'm thinking of another one that you wrote about in the Threat Matrix, which is under Mueller. He refused to let his agents participate in the enhanced interrogation techniques that the FBI was conducting, including waterboarding,
that the CIA was doing.
That the CIA was doing. I'm sorry. Yes. That the CIA was doing. He actually called back FBI agents from some of the black sites or, you know, overseas places where these interrogations were going on, saying, I don't want you involved in that. I don't want us having our hands dirtied by that. Now, you know, he had practical reasons for doing it, which is he didn't want FBI agents having to, FBI agents, unlike CIA officers, have to go on the witness stand in court proceedings and answer questions under oath. And he didn't want his FBI agents tainted with that kind of background. But it was also a real stand for the rule of law.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that that, to me, is one of the questions or challenges that are worth talking about and thinking about as we imagine what an FBI under Kash Patel could do, which is the FBI is this enormously bureaucratic and authority driven, and by that I mean legal authority driven organization. Agents joke, bureaucracy is literally our middle name. And that what I wonder about is, you know, how that grounding in the rule of law, how that, you know, half century DNA of political independence survives a Patel directorship. You know, I think that there is a scenario where Kash Patel becomes director, and, you know, spends all of his days, you know, fighting at the deputy assistant director level in the Hoover building, and the 55 FBI field offices across the nation continue to operate, you know, more or less unchanged, you know, in 95% of their portfolio. Part of what worries me, though, is the influence that someone like Kash Patel has over promotions in the Bureau. And the way that, you know, the primary way that a director shapes the FBI is in who he and, you know, so far they've all been hims, chooses, you know, the next generation of section chiefs, unit chiefs, you know, deputy assistant directors, special agents in charge, you know, and on and on. And that one of the things that really worries me is the way that Patel could influence a generation of FBI leaders, who then, you know, sort of continue to corrupt and bend the FBI for, you know, 10, 15, 20 more years.
You know what? I would argue that, you know, it's really a prescription for chaos above everything else, because I'm just trying to imagine how FBI agents who have been trained to follow rules. I mean, you know, to open up a preliminary investigation, there have to be certain predicates that meet a factual, you know, pass a factual review. To advance it to a more serious, full-scale investigation, there are more hoops that have to be go through. There are more approvals you have to get. And if Patel uses the FBI in a way that, in the way that he's talked about using the FBI, I just don't see how that clash plays out, because agents, many of whom are lawyers, many of whom are accountants, many of whom are, you know, trained to follow the rules that have been laid out over the years to prevent political abuses. I mean, are they going to accept, you know, directives from up high to violate those rules and launch investigations without adequate predicates?
Yeah, that to me is actually one of the great questions of this, is and I think that this might be true actually of a lot of Trump nominees across the government, right. Which is, you know, one of the challenges of appointing people who are fundamentally unqualified to a lot of these roles is they're not going to understand the levers of internal power to use to get the change that they want. You know, right. Again, look at someone like Pete Hegseth. The Pentagon has defeated defense secretaries far more competent and knowledgeable about the U.S. military than Pete Hegseth. You know, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, fought the Pentagon for years during the George W. Bush administration, and he'd already been defense secretary once before. Right. And so, you know, Patel has, you know, minimal at best experience with the FBI. And, you know, you can certainly see a scenario where, even in well-meaning cases where people are sort of trying to do the things that Patel wants them to do, you know, the cases sort of get lost in the paperwork and the bureaucracy and,
right.
you know, as you said, the layers of supervisor sign-off that have to happen, you know, in order for X to happen or Y to happen.
Yeah. So let me pose a sort of, you know, alternative, you know, view to play devil's advocate here. You know, we start with J. Edgar Hoover, who for decades ran the FBI as his personal fiefdom and, you know, did and all sorts of documented abuses resulted. And then we swing towards the independence era of FBI directors like Louis Freeh refusing to even accept a White House pass. And probably the ultimate expression of that independence was James Comey, who sort of celebrated his independence from White Houses, first when he was at the Justice Department and he resisted the Bush White House demands to renew the warrantless surveillance program. But then, you know, obviously, in 2016, he makes a big point of publicly giving extensive comments about why the FBI was not recommending charges against Hillary Clinton, something that he didn't have to do and was widely criticized for doing. And then on his own, you know, in the last days of the election, renews the investigation of Hillary Clinton. And one could argue that that was, you know, Comey sort of, you know, overdoing the independence almost to make a point, that he was trying to make a point about how independent he was, and it got him into a lot of trouble.
Yes, and I think one of the things I've certainly been very critical of Comey's decision making in 2016 previously, I think one of the things that we have come to understand about Jim Comey's decisions were what were originally, I think, seen in the moment as sort of these declarations of FBI independence were very much personal ego decisions of Jim Comey. That these were, and that they were sort of more about, you know, brand Comey than they were brand FBI. And that, you know, I think one of the things that we have seen the Biden administration do, and I would argue the Biden administration has sort of gone too far in the opposite direction, is, you know, respect the independence norms of the Justice Department and the FBI sort of to a fault. And that, you know, that in some ways there might be a reason to swing back some of these institutions more towards, you know, presidential authority, but that Kash Patel is the wrong guy to do it.
Right. I think we certainly don't want the White House weighing in on decisions of who to prosecute, who to investigate. I mean, I think we can say that's a, you know, there ought to be a clear red line on that one. But I take your point about, and in fact, I agree with your point that, you know, that the pendulum may have swung a little too far back. But what is your, what's your take on the Chris Wray FBI? And by the way, I should point out, he's still the FBI director, Christopher Wray, selected by Donald Trump, and still has 3 years left in his term, which means that if Patel is named, Chris Wray will have to be fired.
Yeah. There's been some reporting, by the way, in the last couple of days that, you know, Chris Wray, I don't know the exact phrasing that the reporting took, but the idea being that Chris Wray has indicated that he would resign sort of if asked by the president.
Sure.
And you know, I think for a whole bunch of reasons, that's a terrible idea. I hope if Donald Trump takes office and, you know, indicates a loss of faith in Chris Wray, that Chris Wray makes him fire him. You know, that I think that's actually a really important norm that, you know, the FBI director is supposed to be only removable for cause. You know, that was certainly, that cause was well established and irrefutable in the case of William Sessions in the 1990s. Donald Trump sort of invented cause for Jim Comey in 2017. And I really hope that Wray does not preemptively resign to clear the way for Kash Patel or whomever to take over as director there.
Your take on his stewardship of the FBI?
You know, I think I have I was joking the other day to someone that I certainly have my own set of complaints about Chris Wray's leadership of the FBI. But I guess I will now die on the mountain of having him serve out the last 2 years of his term. You know, I think almost every leadership position ends up being a reaction to the leader before. You know, and I think Wray has overcorrected from the sort of high profile Comey independence swashbuckling Jim Comey era where, you know, Jim Comey is the main character of American politics. And, you know, I think Wray has been a very quiet internal leader in a way that I think has not been, you know, the bully pulpit leader that the FBI needs and that America sort of counts on, actually, in many ways. Now, one of the things that's interesting about that, though, is I think that that may end up hurting Kash Patel's ability to bend and break the FBI in the years to come. And what I mean by that is what I think you have seen in Chris Wray's tenure is that the field offices and the field agents have become sort of more independent and disconnected from Washington and headquarters than they were during, for instance, the Mueller era. You know, Mueller was partly because he was the post 9/11 leader who was sort of remaking the FBI as this, you know, counterterrorism intelligence agency. But Mueller was a really driving leader down into the field. Louis Free was a really driving leader down into the field. And Chris Wray has not been. And I think that that has let the field offices chart their own courses more and field agents work more independently at sort of the far reaches of the FBI. And that it might be harder now for Kash Patel to sort of reunite and rebuild this organization into the, you know, national Gestapo that he wants it to be.
Right. Your point about Wray not using the bully pulpit, far from it. I mean, when I was covering the FBI during the Comey era, I remember he had regular meetings with the press on mostly on the record. He'd occasionally go on background, but, he made himself very accessible. I think you could count the number of press interviews Chris Wray has done, maybe on the fingers of one hand. I mean, I can barely think of any that stand out. But and here's where I think is probably the most terrifying thought about Kash Patel taking over the FBI, obsessing about going after Donald Trump's political enemies. Look at what Christopher Wray has said over the past year in congressional testimony and speeches and elsewhere, that we are facing a threat environment more dangerous than any that he can remember, you know, from the Chinese cyber intrusions into every aspect of, America's communications, Iranian plots to assassinate our leaders, political leaders, including Donald Trump, Russian disinformation, terror attacks, the resurgence of ISIS-K in Afghanistan. And, with those kind of enormous threats out there, the idea that we'd have an FBI director who seems more intent on doing what he's talked about, like, being the fierce loyalist for Donald Trump, that is a pretty scary thought. If you accept what Christopher Wray has said publicly over the past year.
And the other thing, I have done one of those interviews with Chris Wray.
And
the thing that we talked about was the rise and globalization of white supremacist terrorism. The FBI has been vocal, I wouldn't say very vocal, but vocal, that they see, the rise of white nationalism and white supremacist organizations as the greatest domestic terror threat. And to me, one of the real fears of a next Trump administration is those are Donald Trump's voters. That is the rise of far right extremism in the United States is a major part of the movement that has helped propel Donald Trump to the presidency. It was a major part of the push around January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol. And an FBI that organizationally turns away from that threat over the next couple of years, as I would imagine a Kash Patel and Pam Bondi Department of Justice would, that has real repercussions for American lives here at home.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, that white nationalist movement, if that's what it is, or sympathizers, would only be emboldened, I would imagine, if Donald Trump goes through on his plans to issue, sweeping pardons for the January 6th participants, particularly if it includes people, like the convicted Proud Boy folks who were
part of it. By the way, along those lines, one of the things we're hearing a lot of talk about in the wake of the Hunter Biden pardon this week is the, you know, possibility of more preemptive pardons by the Biden, you know, for Anthony Fauci or Mark Milley or Liz Cheney or, you know, other officials who might be persecuted by, you know, a future Trump Justice Department. I think that that's an enormously dangerous line to cross for presidents to sort of start handing out preemptive pardons on their way out the door. And also, I think sort of just fundamentally misunderstands, again, how the FBI or the Justice Department would sort of persecute those people anyway. You know, there is no way that a Pam Bondi sitting in the Attorney General's office in January 2021, you know, looks at a pardon of Liz Cheney and says, oh, well, shoot, Biden's really tied our hands here. There's nothing that we can do to go after Liz Cheney. And, you know, as we talked about earlier in the podcast, there's a ton that the FBI or the Justice Department or the federal government can do to persecute ordinary Americans that don't end with a formal indictment by a grand jury. And, you know, I think I worry that Biden handing out a round of preemptive pardons, you know, does a lot of damage to sort of political norms with no actual benefit to the people that he's handing the pardons to.
Are there any political norms left? I'm not quite sure at the moment.
No.
Look, bottom line, could Kash Patel, do you think Kash Patel could even get confirmed as director of the FBI?
Yeah, it's a good question. And you know, the obvious answer in a normal set of circumstances is no.
Right.
In this set of circumstances, I think the unique weirdness of this moment is Kash Patel is probably only maybe like the fourth most troublesome and worrisome Trump nominee. And
wait, you're saying he was more concretely dangerous and worrisome than
those
than
are
any
different,
of the others.
Which is, okay. I think he's more concretely dangerous.
Yeah.
But he's not sort of personally objectionable in the way that we have seen, you know, Matt Gaetz get sunk. We might still see Pete Hegseth get sunk.
Right.
And so, you know, there are only going to be so many times and places that the GOP Senate is going to be willing to fight on a nominee. And, you know, in sort of the same way that in a normal set of circumstances, Pam Bondi is a totally unqualified leader for the Justice Department, but after Matt Gaetz, she's suddenly a totally non-controversial nominee who is going to skate through Senate confirmation. So
yeah.
I think to me, you know, if people really pay attention to Kash Patel for a while, you know, maybe he doesn't make it. But I think there's also a possibility that he gets to his Senate confirmation vote and, you know, he's sort of still just slightly under the main radar as someone like Pete Hegseth or, you know, RFK Jr. or whoever else is the target du jour, you know,
is a good point.
Eating up the controversy.
I think we may get to the point of, you know, the Senate will be so exhausted after the Hegseth nomination fight and the RFK nomination, the Tulsi Gabbard nomination fight and, you know, the Pam Bondi nomination fight, which, you know, will probably take place as well, that they just may throw up their hands and let Kash Patel go through. But anyway, Garrett, a fascinating conversation. You are one of the best people around to talk about these subjects. So I thank you for joining us and I hope to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me. And I hope that the coming years are so boring we never talk about the FBI director again, but something tells me that won't be the case.
Okay, thanks a lot. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.